People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio and Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. I'm sure you will know by now that the Agatha Christie thriller, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, has just opened at the Theatre on the Bay. And let me tell you that for me, it's one of my favorite Agatha Christie novels because it has the most extraordinary twist. So you need to go along and see it. But we're going to take a different view of theatre this evening with a set and lighting designer who's working on this production, along with many others, Dennis Hutchinson, who's worked on shows ranging from experimental theatre via contemporary dance and musicals to ballet and opera. And highlights include both scenic and lighting designs for all sorts of people, including having worked for a while in New York with the South African production there. So, Dennis, welcome.
Hi, Rodney. Thank you.
The important thing here is that we don't give anything away when we're talking about the play, because it's very easy to let something slip. And as I say, do you agree it's an extraordinary ending, the twist?
It is. I mean, that's the genius of Christie, is that she manages to wrong-foot you every time.
Red herring's gone mad.
Yes, a whole seafull.
Have you worked on Agatha Christie before?
I lit last year's Christie, which was Black Coffee, mm-hmm. and Witness the Prosecution, which was the year before.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So, yeah.
So here you are again. And what I would like to know is, how do you tackle something like this from us? Because you've designed the set and the lighting. Is it a period piece that you have to go back? Is it updated, or what do you do with it?
Well, this is an interesting one because Christie normally wrote her own adaptations of novels. In this case, she didn't do the adaptation for the stage. The novel was published in 1926, so it's the centenary year of the novel.
So it is.
And this is a new contemporary adaptation, which makes it really interesting because the humor's contemporary as well.
Ah, okay.
It is still a period piece, though. The book was set in the 30s. We've moved this forward to the 50s.
Well, that's not just a dramatic change.
It's not a huge change. Well, there's a little world war in between.
Oh, there's that.
Yes, but apart from that. And so it is still very much period and not of today, mm-hmm. In terms of costuming. And I don't do costumes, by the way.
Okay, we're talking about sets and lighting.
Absolutely. No, the secrets of needle and cotton, all too safe with me. But the interesting thing about this is that whereas all of the other Christies are very much drawing room thrillers, and they all take place in one space in continuous time. This takes place in several places, so you've got to move between locations, and obviously that has huge budget implications.
Yes, I was going to say.
And you know, in a theater the size of the Theatre on the Bay, there's a limit to how much you can do in terms of scene changes. So we've had to come up with a concept that we hope audiences will understand and enjoy, to move the action very quickly in a slightly cinematic way without actually having huge pieces of scenery rumbling on and off.
Okay. Cinematic, that's interesting.
Because it needs that kind of speed and that kind of pace going. You know, it's for me a very important thing when you're designing scenery, especially for multiple location shows, is you can't hold the action up. If you have to sit and wait for a scene change, there's a problem.
Exactly. Especially in Christie, I would have thought.
In anything. Oh, in Mamma Mia, you shouldn't have to wait for the scene change.
Okay. You know, that's another story we'll come to, because you're going to work on that later this year.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. We'll come back to that. Let's do Christie.
Right.
So are you given instructions, or do you formulize in your mind what you want to do with a piece?
Well, the great thing about theatre is it's a collaborative form, unlike a lot of other endeavors. And so I normally start, I read the script once, and then I meet with a director, because he or she is going to have a concept as well.
And Alan Swerdlow is the director.
In this case,
he's also done the other Christie's.
He did both of the other two, yes. Yeah. And then you sit down and you have a very long conversation about the piece. Mm-hmm. I know people who go in with an idea. I prefer not to, because again, I like the notion of the collaborative nature, and there's no point in going in with an idea and the director's gone in a completely different direction. Yeah, that's just a waste of time, and life's too short. So that initial conversation is about kind of what is the piece trying to say? What are we trying to emphasize? What do we want to turn the piece into, with respect for, obviously, the author's intentions all the way down? And then I go away and I start sketching and coming up with things that I think could work. And usually I take that into a sort of small paper model, because I find that's easier to show a director than just drawings. Mm. And I draw very badly anyway.
Oh, I would have thought you draw brilliantly as a set
nope.
director.
Okay. There so are the set designers who do. I'm not one of them.
So the 3D idea, therefore, works well.
And also, because a stage is a three-dimensional shape, it's very easy to look at a two-dimensional drawing and misinterpret. Whereas if you actually build it in simple form, it's very clear what relates to what and how. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the way I work. And then there's a lot of argy-bargy that goes on about, can we move this there and can we do that? And you know, lots of no. And then you get to a point where you then start detailing it more and more until you eventually come up with a final product.
And I know Alan quite well, I'm lucky to say, and I think he's a very fine director. Was he sympathetic and generous and giving you ideas and taking ideas away from you?
Well, Alan and I go back a very long way.
Oh, so you've worked with him many times?
Yeah, I've worked with him a lot. I mean, I think our first show together was A Handful of Keys, which is another lifetime ago.
It does seem a long time ago.
That was the first time you work with a director is always quite interesting, because you don't have a common vocabulary. And you have to sound each other out.
Oh, yes.
So there's a lot of playing around to find out how far can I push, how far can I not. Because the interesting thing as a designer is that if you give me the same play and three different directors, I'll give you three different designs.
Oh, that is interesting. Okay.
Because you've got to play to the strengths of the director you're working with.
Yes.
And that's different, and that affects the design.
And then, of course, there's the theater itself, the size of the stage, what the audience will see. And the theater on the Bay is not huge. I would like to call it intimate. It sort of feels big sometimes.
Well, the stage is a little big in relation to the size of the auditorium now. Mm-hmm. You know, that auditorium's gone through several incarnations. It was originally a 450-seater. And then it got cut down and cut down and cut down. It's now about 180 seats. But the stage has essentially stayed the same size. And in this case, because the show plays only Theatre on the Bay and the Peter Turin Theatre at Monte Cassino, they are similar-sized stages. So it's not a huge train smash.
Right.
If you're moving from one theatre to a theatre that's vastly different, that can be a whole other animal.
Where you almost have to start again.
Well, you know, you're never going to get the money to do it twice. So, you know, I always ask, is it going to go anywhere else? And then I tend to overlay the plans of the two venues and go, okay, what's the least space I've got in every direction according to the restrictions of each venue? So that I know it will fit all the venues.
Okay.
You know, if the tour comes up after the event and you've already designed it, that's a little trickier.
Okay. He said gently. Dennis, let's just pause, because then I'm going to talk to you about lighting. You've chosen Mahler as your first piece from the Symphony No. 1. Do you have a Mahler thing?
I do like Mahler very much. And I also think that the Mahler 1 has a ballet waiting to be brought out.
Oh, that's very interesting.
I just haven't been able to persuade a choreographer yet. it's a piece I particularly like. I mean, that cheeky flute in the second movement always gets me.
Right.
And the first time I heard Mahler, I just related to it in such a wonderful way. I know this music. Works for me.
Well, that's great to hear. I'm also a huge fan of Mahler. And this, I always say number one is an easy way into Mahler. Most people say number four. I think number one is the way to start if you want to get on that journey.
I would have thought five is actually the easiest.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. It's just, all that brass.
Yes.
It's easy.
Well, because the movements are fairly long, I've chosen the scherzo, if that's okay with you.
Mm.
Right.
Thank you.
That was the Scherzo of the Symphony No. 1 by Gustav Mahler. And it was the first choice of my guest on People of Note this week here on Fine Music Radio, Dennis Hutchinson, who's a set designer and a lighting designer. And he, in fact, is working on the Agatha Christie play that has just opened at Theatre on the Way, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. And we're desperately trying not to give anything away. But now you've explained very beautifully about set design, but then you've got to light the whole thing. And that's, I've always thought, is where real subtlety must come in.
Well, lighting's really interesting because you're combining several things that often people think are fighting each other. So there's a highly technical aspect to it, which is not to say scenery isn't technical as well. And then there's the more emotive side of things. And most people sort of get the idea that changes in light create changes in atmosphere. And that's a lot of what you do. But your first responsibility is still illumination. You know, the audience have paid to see the actors. If you leave them completely in the dark, they may as well just fax their performances in. And most actors don't like doing that.
I'm sure not.
So there's the technicality of the illumination, but then creating atmosphere around the moment. And the really interesting thing about lighting is that it can change all the time. So what you can do is you can underscore what is happening on stage in terms of action by creating an emotional graph that goes with what the play itself is telling. You know, if you go back to ancient Greece, for example, they always staged their plays so that the noon was where the denouement happened. So the stage got progressively brighter until that climax, and then you went into afternoon. We don't necessarily do it that way anymore. And obviously, they were relying on the sun. Whereas we obviously have a lot of control over what we do. The moment we moved indoors, we started to have control over the light. And for me, you know, the interesting thing is doing that underscoring and also directing the audience's attention, because our eyes naturally go to the brightest point in our field of vision. And the most obvious example of that is a follow spot in a musical. Makes damn sure that the audience is looking exactly where they should be looking. But you can do that just by having areas of the stage that are brighter than other areas as well. So in some respects, what you're doing with light in the theater is akin to what an editor does in film. The editor chooses what you see and what you look at. And by highlighting certain areas of the stage, you can also force the audience's focus where you want it and sometimes away from where you don't want it.
Oh, that is interesting. Yeah. Yes. Playing so tricks.
It's kind of fun. I mean, you know, ultimately, when you're making theater, no matter what department you're in, it's this extraordinary thing that an audience will pay money to come and sit down and allow you to manipulate them emotionally for several hours. I mean, normally that would be illegal.
That's an interesting way of looking at it, Dennis. But also, you mentioned a follow spot. But in a play like this, you wouldn't have follow spots, would you? That's very much a musical thing.
We think of it exclusively as a musical thing in this country, certainly. In Europe, it's not necessarily true. They will often, in Scandinavian countries and Germany, they will often use follow spots in other shows. And it's quite common now on Broadway as well. But generally it's done more subtly for straight plays than it is for musical, because musicals tend to be a little bit brasher,
yes,
as
indeed,
it were.
Indeed.
But it's the ultimate easy way to make sure that people can be seen.
And as you said just now, it's very technical these days, isn't it? Lighting is much more complicated than just turning pots. It's huge, like a control desk.
We now have so-called intelligent lights, which actually have more moving parts than a motor car.
Really?
Because you can control where they point remotely. You can cut bits out of the middle of the beam. You can cut bits out of the edges of the beam. You can change color. And you end up with, you know, depending on the light, anywhere between 37 and 256 parameters that you can control. And that takes quite a bit of organization.
I'm sure it does.
And a lot of little motors hidden inside those lights.
Oh, really? You mean to turn them? And
yeah, you know, every function almost. Has... Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
They are.
Yeah.
So,
but now, just talking about all this sort of thing, you have to be careful, I'm sure, not to be distracting, so that you don't distract the audience where the lighting is perhaps too busy, to use a naive phrase.
You've got me right there. I have a horror of lighting that is over busy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, you don't go to the theater to see the lighting. You go to the theater to see the play.
Yes.
And the lighting should be supporting what the performers are doing, not distracting. You know, there may be moments where you need a distraction for whatever reason, but it shouldn't be a continuous thing. And even in musicals, I mean, for my personal taste, a lot of the contemporary musicals have gone too rock and roll. And I sit there going, if you shine lights in my eyes one more time, I'm going to throttle you. You know, in a concert, a proper rock and roll concert,
yes,
where you're out in a stadium, it's very different because you're generally very far away from the stage. The performers are tiny.
Yeah.
So the light show becomes what it's about. And if you want to see the performers, there's a jumbotron with a close-up of the face. But in the theater, where everything is basically a mid-shot, you don't want to pull focus away from the performers. Or I don't want to.
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And with a play like this one that we're talking about, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, it's, I hope I'm not saying the wrong thing. Is it a challenge to light something like that, where you're dealing with a thriller and you could do all sorts of spooky things, I suppose, which could also be distracting?
Well, again, you know, you've got to work within the context of the text itself.
Yes.
And this one only really has one moment that you can go spooky, as it were.
Okay.
Most of it happens in the drawing room.
Yes.
And, you know, box sets have their own challenges from a lighting point of view because there are walls everywhere. Where do you put the lights? You know, whereas a more open stage, you have much more flexibility in terms of where you can put lights, how you can light people.
Are you doing the lighting at every show?
Or oh, no, no. It work? Oh, please, no. I'm a terrible operator.
So you design it and leave it to the operators.
Yes.
With a theatre on the Bay, and finding out all these backroom things from Theatre on the Bay, is there a lighting booth or are there lights on the stage as well and on the side?
There's a control booth at the back of the auditorium,
yes,
which is where both the sound and the lighting are controlled from. And then there are lights all over the place. And the lights get moved from show to show because the requirements of any given show are different. So everything moves every time.
Oh, okay. I mean, watch extra specially, carefully, when I eventually see this production, to see what the lighting does and to see how it captures the mood of the piece, which must be, well, one of the biggest challenges.
Well, mood is obviously very important, but there are also things like cueing the audience into time of day. So there's a difference between a daytime scene and a nighttime scene,
yes,
between an overcast scene and a bright sunny scene.
That's true.
So there are all of those cues for an audience and all of it supporting the performance, supporting what the actors are trying to do, what the author's trying to do ultimately. Yeah.
The audience is very important. I like to hear you say that a number of times.
Well, you know,
not shining lights into their face, for example.
If you haven't got an audience, you haven't got theatre.
You haven't got theatre, exactly. Dennis, your second piece is by Stacey Kent. Tell me your reason for putting this in.
Okay, when I reached 50 and hadn't had a midlife crisis, I thought I should make an effort.
To and have a midlife crisis.
I didn't have enough money for a Lamborghini.
Okay.
So I started to learn French. And it's remarkably difficult as an adult to learn a language. I'm so jealous of children because in the sort of 3 to 8 area, the brain is hardwired for language. They can learn 20 or 30 words a day. Mm-hmm. As an adult, you're lucky if you can learn 10 a week. But part of what I've been doing because of that study has been engaging more with French singers and that kind of thing. And, you know, obviously I started out in the totally obvious place with Brel and Piaf, who are glorious, both of them. But Stacey Kent is a contemporary jazz singer. And although she's actually originally from America, she does sing in French and she lives in France now. And she makes a really nice sound.
What are we going to hear?
We're hearing a piece called Raconte-moi.
La lumière ruisselle derrière le rideau. Une voix de crécelle dit qu'il va faire beau. Mais je m'en fous pas mal des choses de la rue. Il y a dans tes caresses des croissants tout chauds. Du thé à l'amour et des fruits confus. Sers-moi encore un petit verre d'eau. Raconte-moi des rêves au goût de cachou sur un bout de grève le long de ton cou sans lasser des soleils sur ta peau saline. Dessine-moi une abeille que je te butine. Midi qui klaxonne sur le macadam. Les bistrots bourdonnent, l'ascenseur qui brame. Mais je m'en fous pas mal des choses de la rue. Donne-moi plutôt un savon qui je ferai l'animal pris au dépourvu si tu me fais des choses si douces. Raconte-moi des rêves, des histoires de flou sur le bout de l'air. À tes états d'âme. Mais je m'en fous pas mal des choses de ta vie, de tes rendez-vous que tu n'as pas pris, de tes mercredis qui sont bien remplis et de ton mobile qui n'a plus de batterie. Raconte-moi des rêves, des histoires de flou. Dessine-moi une abeille que je te butine.
Stacey Kent there doing her French thing, as Dennis Hutchinson, my guest, was telling us, that piece called Raconte-moi. And my guest is Dennis Hutchinson, who is a set designer, lighting designer, working in lots of places around the country, because you are based, you said, in Johannesburg.
I am, yes.
But you say you come down here quite frequently, because you said later in the year you're doing Mamma Mia.
Yeah, Mamma Mia is being revived. We did it 2 and a bit years ago, mm-hmm. And that that's in about 6 weeks' time in
Cape Town.
Yes, it is
quite soon.
And then it goes to Joburg as well.
Then what do you do with the sets that you use?
Well, in this case, the sets were put into storage, and so they all got hauled out about a month ago for inspection, and we're going to have to fix that and that and that. And so that process is underway at the moment, touch up a paintwork and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then it all comes back into Artscape.
And the lighting, are you involved with the lighting on that?
I lit that as well, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And quite different from Agatha Christie doing something like Mamma Mia, I'm sure.
Totally. I mean, Agatha, just on a basic level, the Agatha Christie set in the UK with their weather, and Mamma Mia is set on a Greek island with that kind of weather. It's not the same animal.
And then you also said you're lucky, I think, to be working on Oliver later the year, which is Peter Turin's big sort of Christmas December production.
Mm.
Have you ever done anything on Oliver before?
No, funnily enough, I haven't. But one of the very first shows I ever did was the Brickleburg production of Annie, which was in 1978. And at that stage, Annie was at His Majesty's in the middle of Joburg, and Pact were doing a production of Oliver at the old Civic Theatre on the hill. So all the little boys were one end of town and all the little girls were the other end of town.
That's true. I know. It's a good way of thinking about it. And so I would like to know now a little bit about you and how you got into this mad business of theatre.
Well, nobody else would have me.
That's a good answer. Do you come from a theatrical background of acting or anything?
Not really. My father's a professional golfer, and I'm a true example of skill skipping a generation, because I can't catch or throw, much less hit a ball with a golf club.
Right. He's quite famous, your father. He's got the same name, hasn't he? Dennis.
Same name, yes. Bad idea, but same name.
So everyone thinks you're a golfer.
No, they realized pretty soon couldn't possibly be.
Right, okay.
I mean, if I'd had the talent, I could have gone into and followed him. That would have been really cool, because he chased summer all his life, and I'm not a winter person. It was not to be. And he was really good about the fact that I clearly didn't have the skills. I was never pushed in any way. I was allowed to go where I needed to go, which was really kind of him, and I'm grateful for it. And my mom did dance as a teenager. I have three left feet, so that didn't cross over either.
You're making yourself sound completely useless, which we know you're not.
Well, I have my moments, let's put it that way.
Right.
It's hard to know. I had an interest in theater. I saw my first show, which was My Fair Lady at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane in London. And I was underage. In those years, you had to be six to see a show, and I was five and something. And my folks managed to persuade the box office to let them take a box so that I wouldn't disturb the rest of the audience. And apparently I was completely well behaved. I don't remember very much, but I do remember buildings rotating, and the original production was on a double revolve. And then the second show I saw, funnily enough, was also in London. My father gave a golf lesson to Harry Secombe, who was doing Pickwick at the time, and Harry gave us seats to go and see Pickwick, and I remember a huge brick wall moving as well, and going, how is this all happening?
So little seeds are being planted.
Absolutely.
Yes.
When I stopped traveling with my folks, once I started school, of course, it gets more complicated, and then my brother and sister came along, so it became financially impractical. But we still used to go to the theater. I was privileged, if too young, to see the original South African production of The Sound of Music with Heather Lloyd-Jones, who I never really appreciated until I was an adult. I only ever saw her three times, and the first two times I was definitely too young. But when I saw her do Night of January 16th as an adult, I understood why she was the darling of the South African stage, because she was extraordinary. Mm-hmm. She really was. So there was seeing shows all along as well. I think the first time I got backstage, Jods were doing a production of The Man of La Mancha at the Civic Theatre, and the man who came out to play Cervantes, a man called Ian Paterson, was a scratch golfer, and somebody arranged for him to play golf with my dad. And through that came tickets, and Ian arranged for me to go and watch the show from backstage one night as well, which was kind of my first, oh, this is what's happening, mm-hmm. which was really interesting.
Magic was being absolutely revealed to you. And then you just carried on.
Yeah, I mean, in 70, what was it, 74, I suppose, Joan Brickell and Louis Burke were saving His Majesty's Theatre in Joburg, and they opened with the production of Maropa. And I wrote to Louis asking if I could come and lend a hand, and I duly arrived at the theatre, and he put me to work straight away, painting loincloths. I only ever did that once.
Painting loincloths, goodness.
I mentioned earlier, wardrobe and I, not a good combination. But it was an introduction, and at the same time, I also wrote to Manny Manum, who was lighting Barney Simon's production of The Crucible. And I went along to meet him. He didn't arrive because they changed the call, but I met a whole bunch of other people. And for the next year and a half, if there was a move-in happening on a Sunday at either His Majesty's or the Old Alexander, I was there. And the advantage was that by the time I actually left school, a lot of people knew who I was and what I could do. So I never really had to sell myself, which is good because I'm not a good salesman.
That's another thing you say now you're not good at. Anyway.
There's a list.
But we're going to take another piece of music, Dennis. Children Will Listen. Tell me about this Into the Woods song.
Yes, Stephen Sondheim. I think it's a song that has a lot to say for the world right now. The sentiments expressed when I see what's happening all over the place and the complete lack of decent behavior, which is happening especially politically, but in other areas as well. And the song is cautionary, and I think it's cautionary in a really good way.
How do you say to your child in the night, nothing's all black, but then nothing's all white? How do you say it will all be all right when you know that it mightn't be true? What do you do? Careful the things you say, children will listen. Careful the things you do, children will see and learn. Children may not obey, but children will listen. Children will look to you for which way to turn, to learn what to be. Careful before you say, listen to me. Children will listen. Careful the wish you make, wishes are children. Careful the path they take, wishes come true, not free. Careful the spell you cast, not just on children. Sometimes the spell may last past what you can see and turn against you. Careful the tale you tell, that is the spell. Children will listen. Guide them, but step away. Children will glisten. what is true, and children will turn if just to be free. Careful before you say, listen to me. Children will listen. Children will listen. Children will listen.
Well, that's music by Stephen Sondheim, Into the Woods, Children Will Listen. And I hope you did listen carefully to the words, as Dennis sort of implied. Dennis Hutchinson is my guest on People of Note this week. And we're talking about backstage at the theatre, because you can imagine, Dennis, how often Peter Turin sponsors this program. So I'm often talking to his actors and actresses, and directors. So to hear someone from your angle is extremely interesting, because am I right in saying that the theatre world backstage is now really rather high tech, all the latest whistles and things you blow and push and pull? I don't like the fact that you're laughing.
Well, yes. It depends on the theatre, obviously.
Of course.
There are constraints in any theatre. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the interesting things that I do, aside from actually the business of making shows, is that I consult to architects on the building of theatres.
Oh, right. Now, that's interesting.
And
right.
This started out when the Monument Theatre in Grahamstown burnt down, and they were rebuilding it. And I got a phone call from Lynette Maria, who was then the head of the foundation, and they needed a consultant. And so I went in and looked at the situation, and we then went into trying to not just fix the venue but improve it as well. And so that was a really interesting project, because there are a lot of constraints because it's an existing building. And there were a lot of people. The Monument wanted not to lose a festival. So the brief was very clear that we had to be able to do a performance in the venue 1 year after the fire. So we rebuilt everything that was necessary on the stage side, but we left the auditorium as a wreck and built scaffold seating inside the auditorium, partially because that way people got to see the devastation and they tended to dip into their pockets because of it. And what we had from a lot of people, Martinez Basson being one of them, was, why don't you leave it like this?
He would say that. Martinez would say that.
And but it was very much an interesting space, because you had these two worlds that had collided. But the foundation did want to complete it. And so during the second year, we sorted the auditorium out so that it could then open 2 years down the line. And I walked away from that kind of going, I got to build a theater. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And I'm now on, I think, number 29.
No. Yeah. Of building theatres?
Of building theatres, yeah.
Where do you build 29
theatres? All over. I mean, some of them obviously locally. I've done in Senegal, in Uganda, in Tanzania, in Lusaka, and there's part of me going, where's the audience for all these things? But I'm thrilled that they're being built.
Yes,
and it's work I really enjoy, because the nature of theatre itself is totally ephemeral. When a show closes, all that's left is faulty memories.
Mm-hmm.
And when you build a theatre, it's concrete. So the contrast between the ephemeral nature of what goes into the building and the concreteness of the actual building itself is really interesting. So I really enjoy this work.
Have you worked on theatres in South Africa that you've apart from Grahamstown?
Grahamstown, obviously. I was also the consultant for both the Globe and the Lyric Theatres in Joburg, and the theatre on the campus at the University of Johannesburg. I'm working on a couple of other projects that hopefully will come online, one in KZN, which will be quite interesting. It's going to be a soiree room, but with three schools attached, as in a music, a drama and a dance school. So that's a whole different thing.
Yes, and a challenge, I would have thought.
Totally. I've also done quite a lot of refurbs of existing venues to kind of drag them into the 21st century.
Would it be unfair of me to ask you if you have a favorite theatre in this country, in the whole of South Africa?
Yeah, that's a tough one because it's also horses for courses.
Yes,
there are some
true.
Some shows that sit well in certain venues and don't sit well in other venues. Mm-hmm. I mean, of the large venues, I think I still like the Opera House at Artscape over the other provincial arts auditoria.
Right.
It's better proportioned for my taste. Mm-hmm. Of the theatres I've done, probably the theatre at the University of Johannesburg, which is, I like the way the audience relate to the stage in that venue, which is a really important thing. You know, architects think I'm nuts when I meet them for the first time, because the first thing they get from me is, you can't have too many ladies loos. Because I don't know theatre anywhere in the world where there isn't a queue outside the ladies' loo at interval.
Yeah.
So fix that, please.
Have more ladies' loos.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the second thing is getting the relationship between the stage and the auditorium right. There are too many theatres where you feel like the stage is in another city, and that's wrong. Mm-hmm. So that's a critical thing to get really right early on. And I feel that UJ has got that right in very many ways.
What I found quite interesting was when Peter Turin did the Rocky Horror Show a few years ago, he did it here at Artscape, and then he did it at Theatre on the Bay just recently. And it worked so much better at Theatre on the Bay because of that intimate nature of that. The Artscape Opera House, I thought, was too big.
For Rocky, absolutely.
For Rocky, yes.
You know, Rocky started in a disused tiny little bug house cinema.
Yes,
and then moved to the Comedy Theatre in London, which is tiny as well. And the original South African production opened at the Victory Theatre in Joburg, which was then the Victory Cinema.
That's right. And it's small and sort of slightly
also
shabby.
Small and shabby, which is exactly,
exactly
what Rocky
you
needs. You know, there's just a little bit of sleaze in Rocky as a piece. You know, there is no question that putting the piece in the right venue makes a huge difference. And you're better off being in a venue that's slightly too small than a venue that's too big.
Right.
I mean, there was an example of a show that I felt was in the wrong venue was Dear Evan Hansen. For me, the Opera House or the Teatro Joburg was too big. But the same piece in the Drama Theatre at Artscape, and we don't have an equivalent in Joburg, which is a little complicated. But I think the piece would have worked better because of the intimacy. I don't know what the economics of it were, but that's another story.
Right. Well, now, after such a fascinating conversation, we have to end, Dennis. But thank you for taking us backstage.
Only a pleasure.
And I shall keep a lookout for lighting, subtle lighting and sets and other things.
Well, if you notice the lighting, I've done it badly.
Oh, yes, that's true. Oops, I must be careful when next I see you. But tell me now, before you go, what your last piece of music is. Robbie Williams, Mr. Bojangles, there's something.
Well, the thing about theatre is ultimately, whatever you're doing, acting, writing, directing, designing, you're telling a story. You might use different media, but you're still telling a story. And Mr. Bojangles is such a wonderful example of a song that tells a story. So that's kind of where I went there.
All right. Dennis Hutchinson, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Rodney.
Jangles and he'll dance for you in worn out shoes, with silver hair, a ragged shirt, baggy pants. He would do the old South shoe.
he would jump so high, jump so high. Then he'd lightly touch down. Told me of a time he worked with minstrel shows, traveling throughout the South. Spoke with tears for 15 years. How is Doug and he? They would travel about. But his dog up and died. Caught up and died. After 20 years, he still breathes. He said, I dance now and every chance in honky tonks. For my drinks and tips. But most of the time, I spent behind these county bars. You see, sunlight, I drink a bit. Then he shook his head. Oh Lord, when he shook his head, I could swear I heard somebody say, please, please. That's Mr. Bojangles. Calling Mr. Bojangles. Mr. Bojangles, come back and dance, and dance, and dance, please dance. Mr. Bojangles, Mr. Bojangles, Mr. Bojangles, come back and dance, and dance. Back and dance again, Mr. Bojangles.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Yeah.